think this is a moment we've all been waiting for. Because not only is Marianne Williamson one of the leading voices in the spiritual community and a tremendous 14 times over New York Times bestselling author, and especially her latest book, A Year in Miracles, A Year of Miracles. But she's running for Congress. How amazing is that? Oh my goddess. How many of you want to see that happen? Marianne Williamson in Congress. Oh, I'm so goosebumps. Well, here's the way to make that happen. Each one of you, and if you have to go without Starbucks for a week or two, we need your money. But all we need is $5. That's it. If we get $5 from everyone in the transformational community, we can make this happen because we need to have her voice in Congress. And so here's what I need for, how many of you are willing to pledge $5 right here now? Yeah, that looks like 1,300 people. All right, we're going to make this happen. I want all of you to go to this website. And if you want to do 10, do 10. But all we're asking for is 5 right now. MarianneForCongress.com. MARIANNE ForCongress.com. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, the fabulous Marianne Williamson.
Hello, hello, hello. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that so much. And Liz, that was sisterhood, baby. Thank you. Thank you. Have you all introduced yourselves to the people who are to your left and to your right, in front of you and behind you, do you think? Then let's do that now. Introduce yourselves to the person to your left, to your right, in front of you and behind you. Now let's come together, all take a deep breath and close our eyes. Together we see a little ball of golden light. And we see that light begin to grow larger and larger until now it covers the entire inner vision of our mind. And we see for ourselves within this light a beautiful temple. And we see a garden that surrounds the temple and a body of water that flows through the garden. We see that the inside of the temple is lit by this same beautiful golden light. And here we are. For we have been drawn together by the power and in the presence of the divine. And it is to that power that we turn. It is to that power that we dedicate our time spent together, all of our relationships with one another. We dedicate all that we have and all that we are and all that we do to the purposes of love. And so it is. Amen. You know, two big questions that we ask ourselves throughout our lives is, who am I supposed to be? Who am I? And who should I be? And what am I supposed to do? I remember seeing graffiti years ago that I never stopped chuckling at. To be is to do, Schopenhauer. To do is to be, Sartre. Do be, do, Frank Sinatra. And so I want to talk to you this morning, specifically about this issue of doing. You know, there is in A Course in Miracles an instruction to say this prayer every day. Where would you have me go? What would you have me do? What would you have me say? And to whom? You know, there is a book, a gospel, the Gospel of Thomas, supposedly one of the forgotten gospels. And in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus tells the disciples to go out into the countryside and spread the gospel. Now, looked at esoterically, to teach the gospel, to teach means to demonstrate, and the gospel means love. So when Jesus, from a mystical, metaphysical perspective, was saying go out and teach the gospel, he wasn't saying go out and hit other people over the head with our book. He was rather saying go out and demonstrate love. Be love. But in the Gospel of Thomas, the disciples then responded to him by saying, well, what are we supposed to say? And his response to them was, I will tell you when you get there. Now, that's a very interesting idea. The idea that you can afford to enter into any given moment not knowing what to do. That you can afford to enter into any given moment in that Zen space of the beginner's mind. And the correlation to that, the universal theme of beginner's mind, presenting an empty rice bowl to God, in the East they say, so that God can fill it up, is also, another one is, be ye as little children. And we're taught to be as little children because children know that they don't know. And the fact that we think we do know actually limits rather than expands our capacity to do that which we are meant to do. Now, the ego mind says, well, how can I know what to do if I don't know what to do? Well, that's where that intimate connection between our being and our doing comes in. Because when we recognize that the state of our being and care for the state of our being precedes the knowledge that will guide us in right doing, then we know that that space of no thing, i.e. just that empty space, radical availability to the present moment, knowing that our job is to take care of the thoughts and the attitudes and the energy that we are holding in any given moment, we become pliable. Life can be malleable through us. We will instinctively not only know what to say and what to do, but even more importantly, the energy with which we do it will be infused with the power that accrues to us because of our state of being. Now, let's look at this in terms of the cells of the body. First, there's a sperm, there's an egg. And then through this force that no possible rational explanation could actually define or explain, a process begins to occur. A process by which out of that one sperm and that one egg begins a process of cell creation and cell division by which a human brain is formed, and toes, and hair, and a skull, and a heart, and lungs, and a liver, and a spleen. All the extraordinary creations of nature by which cells not only emerge so that they exist, but they know what to do. And what they do when they do it is to collaborate with other cells. And that not only ultimately forms a human body, but once the body is born into the world, the process continues. The heart continues to beat, and the lungs continue to breathe. So that extraordinary process of nature, that same process by which not only did the embryo become a baby, not only does the baby become a body that then continues to grow and to function, that same nature is seen as a bud turns into a blossom and an acorn turns into an oak tree. What happens when one cell in the body
instead of dedicating what it is to collaboration with other cells, in order that together they foster the healthy functioning of the organ and the organism of what they are part of, what of which they are part. Because that's what happens in a healthy body. The cells not only appear, but they know what to do. And what they do has to do with collaboration with other cells. Now, what do we call it when a cell says, I don't want to. I don't want to just join with other cells to serve the healthy functioning of the bigger organ. I mean, what about me? I want to go off and do my own thing, okay? And I'm going to find other cells like me who think the way I do because they just want to cluster together and do our thing. Well, we know what that is, ladies and gentlemen. It's called cancer. That's a malignancy. When the cell, for whatever reason, forgets the natural programming by which it knows what to do. It forgets the natural programming by which it collaborates with other cells to foster the healthy functioning of that which is higher than it. And as the individual cell does its function within the whole, collaborating with other cells, the cell itself is glorified. If the cell forgets its functioning, goes insane, becomes cancerous, goes off to do its own thing, joining with other cells only for that purpose, that's called a tumor. It is a malignancy. And it not only risks the destruction of those organs, it thereby risks its own destruction. And from a spiritual perspective, what has happened on the planet is that a malignant consciousness has taken hold. A consciousness which is not about becoming who I am so that I can play with you. Because what I want is to become everything that I can be. I want to be my highest creative manifestation so that I can meet you in the place where you're at your highest creative manifestation. And together we are going to serve something that is bigger than either of us and thereby find our individual glorification. And that process is not only true in the external realm of nature, it is also true in the internal realm of nature. A mysterious force has a plan for the acorn that it would become an oak tree. A mysterious force has a plan for a bud by which it becomes a blossom. A mysterious force has a plan by which that embryo becomes the baby. And that force does not just drop us off on the planet and say, okay, it's yours from now on. Do whatever you want to do. You can do whatever you want to do. However, while the difference between you and me and the cell and the body, you and me and the embryo, is that the embryo, from what we know of anyway, has no choice, you and I have a choice in every moment. Do I want to listen to my natural guidance system, which will lead me to become the fullest actualization of my own self that I'm capable of, and then will guide me to collaboration with others in such a way that together we create an even higher, more fantastic life than we could have done alone? Or do I not want to? And so even though the drive towards self-actualization, which is inherent in nature, the universe is invested in our self-actualization. How do we know that? Because everything we go through in life takes us there. As the Course in Miracles says, it's not up to you what you learn. It's merely up to you whether you learn through joy or through pain. We can definitely see, if we look back on our lives, how every situation we went through was there to teach us something. Every situation that we are in is an invitation. You're going to step it up? You're going to be better than you were last time you played that same thing? You're going to be more ethical, more honest, have more character, more giving, more generous, more merciful, more forgiving, more strong, more living in your possibility, more living in the present, having released your own agenda, having released your grievances. You're going to live in that space or not. It's completely up to you. And if you choose not to, that's okay. Because the universe being invested in your self-actualization has no judgment on that. It will just bring the exact same lesson around again in another place with other people. So you can't get out of it. You will become self-actualized. We're going to get there. We're going to get there slower. We're going to get there fast, but we're going to get there. Which is the same thing as saying we can get there through pain or we can get there through joy. But the universe is not only formed and constantly reforming itself to support your self-actualization and your self-actualization and your self-actualization through what the Course in Miracles calls a highly individualized curriculum, meaning you meet who you meet and you meet who you meet and you go through what you go through and you go through what you go through. But it is also invested in our self-actualization. So not only is it that we are constantly being guided as individuals, constantly provided situations, giving us the opportunity to become the highest manifestation of who we are capable of being in any lifetime. But collectively, we are going through the same kind of process. Nations go through phases, developmental phases. A species goes through a developmental phase. The human race goes through a developmental phase. We know this biologically. The study of physical anthropology, the study of biology, the study of archaeology, the study of cultural anthropology, we see this. And we in our own time are living through these dramas as much as at any other time in history. But sometimes in our collective experience, where we know, even if we were to say, well, what do I do? Even if I'm to accept all that, even if I'm to say, yeah, that sounds really right, but how do I know where I fit in? Well, not every cell is assigned to the liver. Not every cell is assigned to the blood. Not every cell is assigned to the heart. Not every cell is assigned to the bones. And that's how life works in nature. Some of us are assigned to the arts. Some of us are assigned to education. Some of us are assigned to business. Some of us are assigned to seminars. Some of us are assigned to politics. Some of us are assigned to whatever. And how do we know? We can feel it. We feel, I really want to write a book. That's your assignment. I really want to do a great experiment or create a great project. That's your assignment. Now, from a spiritual perspective, the Course in Miracles, anyway, would say, no one is special. Everyone is special, but no one is special. So if none of us are special, that means nobody's assignment is special. There's a difference in the spiritual world between the concept of form and content. We all have different forms of service. Your form might be the arts. Your form might be business. Your form might be the military. Your form might be education. But the content is all the same. We are sent out into the world to be love. And some of us are sent out in the world with the assignment of uplifting the energy in the area of education. Somebody else's assignment is to uplift the energy in the area of the arts. Somebody else's assignment is to lift the energy in the area of whatever it is. The point is not what we are doing, but our sense of why we're doing it. And also how we know what it is we're supposed to do. Now, we all have within us, as we know, this mind. We could call it in many books, such as The Course in Miracles, it's called the ego mind. Doesn't matter what we call it. But it is the belief in a separated self. And it is the fear-based mind. Why? Because it is based on a false assumption. It is based on the assumption that we are separate from one another. Now, you know, there's that image in the Course. You are like sunbeams thinking you are separate from other sunbeams. You are like a wave in the ocean thinking you are separate from other waves. Now, if I'm a wave in the ocean, just one wave, and I think to myself I'm separate from every other wave, How could the ocean not terrify me? The ocean is huge, and I'm just one little wave, and at any moment it could overwhelm me. But what if instead I realized, I'm so one with the ocean, because there is really no place where I stop and it starts. I am connected to every other wave. And just like on the earth and the sky, when a butterfly flaps its wings on the South Pole, we know that it affects the wind currents on the North Pole. When any one wave moves in the ocean, it moves the ocean. So from the perspective of books like The Course in Miracles, it says you actually are a wave connected to the ocean, but living on this earth, you are hallucinating that you are separate from the rest of the ocean. And in this hallucination, we are terrified of the rest of the ocean. Now, enlightenment is a shift. It's a shift from identifying ourselves only with the body to identifying ourselves with the spirit, identifying only with the suit of clothes to identifying with whatever it is about us that was here long before we were born into the body and will be here long after we are born into the body. And the body is just the suit of clothes. It's our headquarters while on this earth. To the extent to which I identify only with my body, first of all, I'm in fear. And second of all, because that's the realm I chose to identify with, I am heir to the laws of that rule this realm of experience. But if I shift and I identify not with my body, knowing that I am so much more than a being of just three dimensions, that I'm not just a wave, I'm the ocean, that even though on the level of physical reality you're over there and I'm over here, there's actually no place where my spirit stops. It doesn't stop at my body. Therefore, it goes out and yours comes out and there's really no place where you stop and I start. And that's who I really am. I'm not just this separate self. I am, as you are, that space we share. Then that decision, that mere decision to see ourselves not as isolated beings, but as one with each other, shifts not only who we think we are, but what mind we listen to for our guidance as to what to do. The mind which sees me as separate is invested in order to preserve its own life in my doing things that will actually increase my sense of separation. But it doesn't tell me that at the time. It doesn't tell me, I'm going to tell you to do something which is going to feel to you at the time absolutely reasonable. It's going to feel to you at the time like you're just taking care of yourself. Or it's going to make you feel at the time like you're really bonding with the other person, such as inappropriate sex, where we feel we're going to connect more deeply, but if it's not the right spiritual guidance, it will end up making us feel more separate rather than closer to that person. And so for us to realize, you know, that mind, that ego mind, one of the things I notice is that it's not only the mind that tells you to do the wrong thing, but it's also the mind that tells you after you've made the mistake, what a jerk you were for having made it. And you're like, I thought that's what you told me to do. And that's when we begin to realize that that's not our natural guidance system. Our natural guidance system, the same guidance system that makes the cell collaborate with other cells, that's a whole other level of mind. And that's why we pray, and that's why we meditate, and that's why we come to conferences like this, because we are seeking a different level of counsel. And as we find that different level of counsel, we then and only then know what to do. Now, there's a line in the Course in Miracles, he says, the presence of fear is a sure sign that you are trusting in your own strength. I say to people all the time, people say something like, I'm so afraid to go do this, I'm so afraid to go do that. One of the things that really helps me is reminding myself, Marianne, you are the faucet, you're not the water. That's all you are. And the presence of fear is a sure sign you're trusting your own strength. I can only feel that fear when I think it's about me. But when you go into any situation and you've simply asked, where would you have me go? What would you have me do? What would you have me say? And to whom? I'm simply making myself radically available. My responsibility is to ground myself, particularly in the mornings, ladies and gentlemen, in the state of being which will make right-minded guidance about what we should be doing come naturally. You know, most people wake up in the morning and they wash the dirt off their bodies because they don't want the dirt on their body as they go off into the day. But you know, there's a line, miracles are everyone's right, but purification is necessary first. What is a miracle? A miracle is that shift from I'm a body to I'm a spirit, which is therefore from fear to love, which is therefore from blame to blessing, which is therefore from living in the past or attached to the future, from living in the radical openness of the present, in this great big empty space of, I don't know, I'm just here. I love those people who have bumper stickers that say, God is my co-pilot. I mean, the way I look at it, if I'm in a plane and I'm in the cockpit and God's there, he can fly this plane. Would you not prefer to be the passenger? And so this idea of this time of relaxation and meditation and prayer, so that you're not just washing the dirt off your body, you're washing the stress off your mind, the stress off your heart. And when we wash the dirt off our body, it's just ours. You know, maybe one other person's, for some of you maybe two. But when you're washing the stress off your mind or your heart, you're washing the stress not only that's yours, but everybody in Somalia and Syria and Afghanistan. Everybody going through all the craziness and the stress of life today. And so to the extent to which we are identifying with all that stress, we cannot be transformers of that stress. To the extent, however, that we ground ourselves through whatever our serious spiritual practice is in a realm of true being, then we will go out into the world, go out into the countryside, demonstrating, teaching the gospel, which is love. And there will be doing to do. Now, some people have said to me, particularly since I felt in my guidance, once again, nobody's guidance is special, nobody's guidance, nobody's function is special, but we all have that which at some point appears in our life, like this is your guidance for what comes next. And for me, as Liz was saying, and as you all know, I am running for Congress in California. And this was a big decision. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. It means a lot to me. Thank you. And this was a deep inquiry in my heart and in my mind that went on for a good solid year. It was not easy. It's not something you do impulsively or casually. And I'm reminded of a line also in the Course in Miracles that what the Spirit tells you to do might seem startling at the time. And that's because the ego mind does not know what's going to happen tomorrow. The ego mind does not know what's going to happen around the bend, but the Spirit does. And not only does the ego mind not know what's going to happen tomorrow, but the ego mind is always trying to compensate for what it felt was lacking yesterday. And so because the core belief of the ego mind is that something was lacking, then whatever we do will be sure to lead us into another condition of lack, because that is our core belief. And so just as you can imagine a cell in the liver being sent a whole picture, oh, I understand, this is what the cells in the heart are going to do, and this is what the cells in the feet are going to do. No, it just knows what to do as a cell in the liver. And the fact that we don't know how what we're doing necessarily fits into what everyone else is doing is not our weakness, it's our strength. Now, some people have said to me, not many, but some have asked in the spiritual community, and I have strong beliefs about why those of us who are on the spiritual path of personal growth, recovery, and so forth are the last people who should be sitting out the great social and political questions of our day. Because if you have a clue as what to change is what changes one life, you're the one with a clue as to what would change the world. Because the world is just a collection of people. And so there's a way in which Any of us who understands what transforms crisis to opportunity in our own lives, knowing that it's not enough to just fix things on the outside, but that a deep inquiry must be undertaken, whereby we ask ourselves, who am I really? What am I doing? What are the principles I stand for? Do I even actually stand for those principles? Where do I have shadows I need to look at? Where do I have character defects? Where do I need to change? Where do I need to atone? Where do I need to make amends? Where do I need to change course? And what those of us in the realm of personal growth know is if we do that work, if we make that internal inquiry, and if we are brutally honest with ourselves, and we do make the changes that we know we need to make, then our lives do transform, and new beginnings do occur. And renewal does emerge, and miracles happen. Well, I feel that that's the same kind of inquiry that a nation has to make in order for a nation to transform. I think America, for instance, has to take a deep look at itself. Who are we really? What are the principles on which we stand? Do we really? What are our character defects? What are our shadows? Where do we need to atone? Where do we need to make some amends? Where do we need to make some changes? And where could those miracles that we see happen for us as individuals then could happen for a whole nation because the conversation is the same? And it has seemed to me that those of us who are interested in spirituality and personal growth are actually withholding our gifts if we don't enter the realm of that public discourse. Because who better to institute, initiate, inaugurate, and hold that conversation than those of us who hold that conversation in our daily lives all the time. But what I've found has been very interesting to me, and that is that just as we seek to change our lives on an individual level, and the ego does not say, oh, that's great, you want to self-actualize, that is so sweet. You want to become enlightened, that is gorgeous, let me help you. Anytime the ego is telling us that, it's just telling us that as part of its sly and insidious nature to lure us into the very things that will keep it from happening. And I feel I'm up close and personal now with this run for Congress of seeing not only how that resistance to a greater awakening occurs inside us as individuals, but also occurs inside of us collectively. Now, sometimes I get the question, as I was saying, why should we be involved with politics? Because we should be about conscious things. We should be about the light. We should be about creating the new. Well, you know, also as part of our work, and I know Arielle is here, and dear Debbie Ford, who lives on in our hearts and will forever, reminded us that you must look at your own shadows. The way it is articulated in the Course is, you can't bring the light to the darkness, you must bring the darkness to the light. And so we have to do that as a nation and as a species, as much as we have to do that as individuals. You can't just pour pink paint over it and pretend it's not happening. In a national sense, where we have, for instance, in the United States, I don't think the average American even realizes this, we have the second highest child poverty rate in the advanced world. We're second only to Romania. I don't think the average American realizes this. Because of our part of our collective ego is keep it to the side so that we don't have to look. I don't think the average American realizes we have the highest mass incarceration rate in the world. Higher than Russia, higher than China, higher than Iran. We have 2.4 million people who are in the prisons in the United States, even though during the 1970s there were 300,000. And for an African-American man living in the United States today, there is a 1 in 3 lifetime probability of incarceration. This is a moral scourge. I don't think as Americans we don't care about that, but we don't necessarily look at that because we are not shown that, because the collective ego of our system is to pretend that everything is just fine. And you and I, because we are part of this conversation in the transformational community, what happens to people who have real problems but go around just pretending everything's just fine? How do they fare, huh? They don't fare well. And if you see somebody that you know, somebody that you love, who is acting recklessly and acting irresponsibly, particularly if there's an addiction, you don't just say, oh, well, too bad. You do what you can. Sometimes you actually stage an intervention because you love that person. I can't watch you do this to yourself because I love you. I can't. Have you seen what you're doing to your kids? Have you even noticed your kids recently? Have you noticed your house recently? Have you noticed what you're doing to your home? I can't just stand here. I have to say something. That's what we do with each other as people. And I think that that same urge of love to not be silent when we're standing in front of each other and seeing each other self-destruct, we say something. And that's why I'm running for Congress, because I feel we, the citizens of the United States, need to say something. If only you all lived in California District 33. Now, going back to this issue that some people ask, well, what about not going into the darkness? But you know, in the Course in Miracles, there's powerful imagery. Remember when we were talking before about how the wave that thinks of itself as separate from other waves is just hallucinating? Well, yes, from a spiritual perspective, this is all a dream. But we don't awaken from the dream by just pretending that we are awake, because you can't be selectively awake. You can't be selectively conscious. I'm awake in my relationships. I'm awake with my body. I'm awake with nutrition. I just don't want to go to politics because it's so unconscious. But how could it be more, could it possibly be more conscious if we, for whom the conscious thought is the thing, are not putting our conscious thoughts there? And what I love in the Course is it doesn't say you're going to go from the bad dream, and we all know what the individual bad dream is, a life of anxiety, a life of depression, a life of suffering, and all the attendant forms that that can take in our lives. That's the bad dream. And the bad dream in terms of a larger collective is poverty and war and environmental degradation. Those are bad dreams. But when people say, but we're not supposed to enter into the dream, that's not what spirituality and personal growth says about our personal suffering. We are to transform the bad dream to the happy dream. And then from the happy dream, we can awaken. So when we are taught to go out into the countryside, i.e. the world, and teach, i.e. demonstrate, the gospel, i.e. love, that means we go into the illusion. And we look like everybody else, because we are like everybody else on a human level. But we are carrying something. We are carrying something that every person has. Nobody's special. Nobody's indispensable. Nobody has internally what everybody else doesn't have. But it's like the universe is like a house that is wired for electricity. And each of us are lamps. And it doesn't matter what the size of the lamp, and it doesn't matter the shape of the lamp. It doesn't matter the design of the lamp. What matters is whether or not the lamp is plugged in. And that's what happens every time we meditate, every time we pray, every time we forgive, every time we choose the present, every time we let go the past, every time we let go the future, every time we let go our grievances, we are just plugging in, plugging in, plugging in. And so it's not about the lamp, it's about the electricity that is surging through the lamp. And that is what it means to say that we are here to be the light unto the world. But my personal light doesn't cast out the darkness of the world. Your personal light doesn't cast out the darkness of the world, because the light is the realizing that you personally are no big deal and I personally am no big deal. And yet, when we realize in a very humble place that, well, my own one personal body self is no big deal, however, there is in me, as there is in every person, nothing short of the power of God. And therefore, I am being sent on a mission. Some of us, the mission is art. Some of us, the mission is business. Some of us, the mission is education. And we are all here in these missions to collaborate with others who are also put on their mission. So through some great central intelligence, there really is, believe it or not, a central intelligence. that knows how we can each collaborate with each other in a way that serves the whole. And the line, the metaphysical concept, he says, is it reasonable to assume I would give you a job to do and then not provide you with the means of its accomplishment? I heard a spiritual teacher say recently, we are exiting the age of karma and entering the age of dharma. For a long time, we've been focusing on how to work out our stuff. And I don't think that ever stops until, suppose, once somebody becomes a totally enlightened master. But unless that's anybody else in the room, I don't know of any. I think they exist. I'm not saying they don't. But I know in my life and the life of people I know, we're still working out our stuff. That never stops. The age of karma never stops. So the age of dharma seems to me what all of us are asking now. What do I do? You know, we might not be perfect, but at a certain point in life, it's like, I'm not perfect yet, but I'm good enough. I'm not perfect yet, but I'm a heck of a lot better than I used to be. I'm not perfect enough, but I'm not going to get more perfect just being here by myself trying to be more perfect. I'm going to get more perfect by entering into the line of dharma, the line of function, the line of mission, whereby I give to a force that is greater than myself, my hands, my feet, that we pray, please use me. And then when we pray to be used, by definition, we are sent to collaborate with other people who similarly, in their own minds, in whatever way, have prayed to be used. And we find ourselves having all of the experiences and the relationships that we were trying to figure out how to have before we were going out and doing what we were capable of doing. I see politics as just our collective conversation. Gandhi said politics should be sacred. He didn't mean it should be religious, dogma, doctrine, any of that. He meant it should be the place where we have the deepest, most authentic conversation. And we do that with each other. We do that one-on-one all the time. We do that with maybe two, three other people all the time. But we need to have a deep, sacred, meaningful, mindful, wise conversation together as citizens about who this nation is and where this nation is going and what our character defects are and where we need to change. Our greater political conversation, our group conversation, should be the space of our deepest dialogue. And yet it has become the space for our most shallow dialogue. Now, I want to tell you something in conclusion. My experience, and I announced that I was running for Congress at the end of October, my experience in my district and through social media, people in other cities as well, engaging a collective conversation in the way I'm describing has been so beautiful and so inspiring because I believe that we are decent, good, noble people. People said to me, Marianne, you live in one of the wealthiest districts in the country. You can't go talk to people in Beverly Hills about starving, you know, poor children who need preschool and are 1 in 5 are food insecure. You can't go talk to people in Bel Air about mass incarceration issues. And I'm so happy to be able to report that has not been my experience. Because I said from the beginning, I'm not talking to the rich in you or the poor in you. I'm not talking to the black in you or the white in you. I'm not talking to the Republican in you or the Democrat in you. I'm talking to the American in you. I'm talking to the place where we are all the same. And that's why I'm running as an independent. There's no filter. I love it. We're in a room. Nobody knows who's a Democrat. Nobody knows who's a Republican. I can't tell you the stress it takes out of the room. And we can actually talk. JFK said, let us seek not the Democratic answer, the Republican answer, but the right answer. And when people have said to me, how do you know how to do this? How do you know how to bring into a political meeting this energy? I know, because that is what we do. That is what we do. We're not involved in an old conversation that is separate and adversarial. We know that you start the conversation empty. People will say to me, now, Marianne, what are you going to say? Do you know exactly what you're going to say? Do you know what your talking points are? I remember at my announcement address, you know, the political operative. Okay, now keep it only to 12 minutes, only 12 minutes. I wouldn't possibly want to listen to you for longer than 12 minutes. You know that, right? Do you have your speech memorized? Or you know exactly the point you're going to make? And I just went, thanks. And I talked for 40 minutes and everything worked out pretty good. You can't, you know, and it's been very difficult and very challenging. It's a strange hybrid. Because if you're actually forging a political campaign, you have to have some people who know the specifics of political campaigns. There are compliance issues, legal compliance issues, fiduciary compliance issues. And so that marriage of the consciousness that we're all so interested in, which is why we're all here this weekend, and that world is not an easy one. I'm not going to pretend it's easy. When I was talking to Ariel and Brian before this talk, they said, how is it? I said, it is at once the most inspiring, the most beautiful, the most amazing thing, and the most difficult thing I've ever done. Because people are ready. We are so ready in this country and on this planet to evolve, to take the conversation of the heart, not just into our own individual lives. You know, Mahatma Gandhi, with his philosophy of nonviolence, Martin Luther King said about him that he was the first person to take the ethic of love and apply it not just to personal relationships, but to make it a broad-scale social force for good. What Gandhi believed, what Dr. King believed, was that love could heal not only our bodies, not only our personal relationships, but our larger social and political relationships as well. You start saying that, though, in the political domain as it exists today, the collective ego's response is to call you New Age and woo-woo and so forth. Now, I believe to those who say that it's completely naive to say that love should be our bottom line in society as well as everywhere else, I say that those who believe that this civilization as we know it can survive another 200 years if we do not make love the bottom line, they are naive. They are naive. And the good news is this conversation that we're having here today, ladies and gentlemen, this is not the fringe stuff anymore. This is mainstream. Today you're fringe if you do not know that conversation. My friends, my political friends say to me, oh, Marianne, when you're out on the campaign trail, you can't go talking about the vortex and the field and the resonance of the conversation. I said, yes, I can. I'm in Los Angeles, District 33. My political friends have said, oh, Marianne, I know you've like raised some funds at yoga places and you're doing these like yoga fundraisers, but you really shouldn't mention this on the campaign trail. It'll make you sound kind of funny. I said, honey, if everybody in this district who has a yoga mat votes for me, I win hands down. And so we, ladies and gentlemen, just have to claim our space. It's been convenient for us staying over here in this cozy place. It has worked for us, you see, that they ignore us. It has worked because we don't really want to be about that anyway. So it's kind of like a house and there are two stories. And those who only think that we can change the world by working on the effect and we never have to look at the cause. We can change the world by just managing the symptoms and we never have to really look at the disease. And we're going to handle everything just on the earth plane, and that's because we're serious people. Those of us who've known that, like, so not, we've been happy to go up to the second floor. It's just so much nicer up there. There's a balcony. We can see the stars from here. We can just lounge up here. Let them just be down there doing what they do. Except they're burning the house down. And when that happens, ladies and gentlemen, the second floor goes too. So I'm reminded of a fantastic story of the Hindu goddess Durga. And I read this in a book by China Galland. And the Hindu goddess Durga, she just loves to lounge up there. She just doesn't, she loves to oversee everything. She's in her total goddesshood. But the people down in the world were going through a terrible, terrible time. And they kept praying to Durga. Durga, come down and help us. Durga, come down and help us. Durga, come down and help us. She's like, no, I'm lounging. And she couldn't help but notice that times got worse and worse for the people. And that is, they kept struggling with the demons in their midst. Every time they would cut off the head of one demon, more heads would appear. And that's because, of course, they were only working on the effect. And so they would change a symptom and the symptom would reappear. They would change the cause and the cause would come back. And she saw that things were getting very, very, very dark for the people. But they kept praying to Durga. And finally, Durga descended. She came down amongst the people. And through her presence, all the demons were slain. All the demons dissolved. All the demons disappeared. The people said to Durga, please, please don't leave. Don't leave. Don't leave us. We need you down here. Don't go back up to where you were. And she said, no, I have to go back. This isn't my kind of place. She said, I'll be up there. And if things get really, really bad again, I'll come back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what I think. They're bad, and she's back. We're it. I love you. Thank you very, 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 very much. Cool. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. And now we get to spend the rest of our time together. I'll answer questions. We can talk about anything you want to talk about. I know, you know, these times are so amazing when we spend time together in a place like this. Because it's very difficult to lie to yourself in a room like this. It's very difficult. I think one of the values, one of the main values of being at a conference like this or any serious spiritual or personal growth thing is that your subconscious is permitted. Your subconscious is permitted to really open itself up to you with all its riches. So take very seriously the questions you have right now. Take very seriously the answers you are getting right now. So, who has the microphone? Where are the microphones? How does that work? Lady over there has a microphone. Here has a microphone. Raise your hand, and somebody will come to you, and let's talk about whatever you want to talk about. This lady right here, where should we go? How is this working? This lady right here. Thank you.
Raise your hand.
Oh, I'm not supposed to be talking. Sorry about that.
Great. Thank you.
You have a voice. I'm wondering, Marian, do you have a sense of what percentage of Congress already has sort of metaphysical New Age leanings? I know a lot of them feel that way but are hiding it. That would be my interpretation anyway.
My experience of Washington is that the people there are no different than people anywhere else. I think Washington is filled, both political parties, with some really wonderful people who really did go there for the right reasons. That is my honest belief. What we have in this country, however, is we have developed over the last few decades a legalized system of corruption in which moneyed forces, whether it's individual money, union money, corporate money, exerts such undue influence over the functioning of our politics and our government compared to that which is wielded by an individual citizen, that people, in order to get elected and stay elected, feel beholden to those moneyed forces. They are caught in this system. And particularly with the party system, this is what the party is going to do. This is the way you have to vote in order to get the chairmanship or whatever. That's why both I'm running as an independent and also when Liz was talking to run a grassroots campaign. You know, the way America works today, if you don't either take those PAC contributions or those super PAC contributions as independent expenditures in your campaign or have personal wealth to the tunes of millions of dollars, don't even think about running. And the reason I felt that this might be possible is what Liz was saying. I thought, gosh, if everybody who reads our kind of books sends me a dollar, I could do this. You know? So I think, and that's the value of a grassroots campaign and not being beholden to a party. I know what it's like to be free. I'm just saying what I'm saying, and I'll do what I do. If you don't like it, send me back. I have a job. You know? But most people there are caught in this system, and I think they're wonderful people there. And, you know, somebody said to me at a lecture the other night, just the other night, it wasn't a lecture, it was at a meeting, at a lot of yoga people, he said, how are you going to handle going to Washington where everyone is so unconscious, where they're so unspiritual, where they don't know anything about what we know? How are you going to handle that? I said, well, my path teaches me to handle it this way. Dear God, I am having the most arrogant thoughts. Dear God, I'm having this thought that I know and they don't know. I'm having this thought that somehow I'm more spiritual than other people. Dear God, I am bringing such toxicity there. Please heal me. Me. We're not sent to read other people's inventory. We're not there here to be vigilant about other people's process or to monitor anybody else's path. We have a 24-hour day job monitoring our own. And the ego has us monitor other people's as a way of getting us to avoid taking care of our own. And so I don't have this idea that Washington is toxic, but I'm going to come in with some spiritual vibration. I mean, that is the opposite of where we should ever be. But I think the idea that, you know, like Congressman Tim Ryan and Mark Sanford, they have a mindfulness caucus. I would certainly join that. But more than that, I would do, if I have the honor and the privilege of becoming a congressperson, I would do as I do now. Before I went into work every day, I would just blast that place with love. And I would think of each person there that perhaps I hold a judgment or a grievance towards. I would release it into the hands of God. I would try my best to be completely, radically empty and available at every moment. I would remember that I am only there, as the Course says, to represent Him who sent me. I would have no agenda except the agenda of love. And I would absolutely expect miracles. Who's next? I see a lady there. Yes.
Hi, I'm Mari from Norway. And I'm really wondering, what are the core value shift you see in politics right now?
What are the core
value shift you see in
what
politics?
What are the core values in politics right now?
What's the shift you see right now?
In?
Shift.
Shift. Oh, what is the core value shift in politics?
Yeah.
Well, let's look at what even that means. Politics, the word, comes from a Latin root, which means of the people. So the value shift in people is that which we all know. It's a shift from fear to love, from woundedness to healing. Everything that this conference is about, that's what the value is, the value shift in people. Unfortunately, because we are having a crisis of democracy now, and because of the undue influence of money, the average American is locked out. Our government is today, much as Martin Luther King used to say, the American people are far more compassionate than the American government. So I'd like to say that the shift in politics is also from fear to love, but I can't say that because we haven't gotten in there the way. And that's what I would like to see and what I know will occur, whether I win this election or not. I feel strongly in my heart, and it has been difficult at times, ladies and gentlemen, but I have not for a moment doubted the decision to do this, because this conversation with which we have already transformed mainstream society, we've done it already. Business is not the same. It's happening inside business. It's happening inside education. It's happening in the realm of relationships. It's happening in the realm of religion and spirituality. It's happening in the realm of psychotherapy. This is just that last place we've just gone, ugh, we don't want to. But it's just like starting a different conversation anywhere else. And so given the fact that the status quo and the resistance, as I said before, you seek to change in your individual life, the ego doesn't say, oh, okay. And I see how the system doesn't say, oh, okay. But I also see, as we all see, the little sprigs of hope. Being on this campaign, people have asked me what it's like. It's the best of times I've ever had and the worst of times I've ever had. The actual talking to people, to voters, to just people about what we all feel and what we all want is more inspiring than anything I've ever done. But the actual dense materiality of a political campaign is worse than I even expected. It is. And the money that you need and all of that, right? So the shift is happening. I don't think it's quite happening yet. But let me tell you something about it not happening yet. You said you come from Norway. I know that you know that people from other countries look at the United States and roll their eyes routinely. Cannot believe we are so asleep about what's going on this planet. Cannot believe we're in such a stupor. Cannot believe we're so distracted. Cannot believe we're so clueless about what's going on. However, you also know, I assume, ma'am, that the very people who roll their eyes know that when Americans do wake up, we slam it like nobody's business. And that is what I feel is happening now. Americans sometimes stay asleep too long. It is a characterological facet of the American mind. But when we wake up, oh, baby. And I believe we are living at one of those times in our history where a critical mass of people are putting their heads up, looking around and going, what is going on here? What's going on here? And that's how things change, you know. I feel in my political campaign the exact same thing I have felt in every other aspect of my career. Then I'm not saying anything everybody I know isn't saying. I'm just saying it in the microphone. You know, because when I was younger, really crazy things would happen. And then you would go, well, we don't have to worry. I mean, it's so obviously unconstitutional. I mean, they won't let that happen. You don't say that anymore. They are perpetrating it. If it was only the NSA spying, if it was only the National Defense Authorization Act, which gives our government the right to legally detain indefinitely American citizens, if it was only the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a multinational corporate coup, if it was only drones coming, if it was only the oil companies dominating our climate change policies, if it was only the health insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies dominating our health policies, if it was only the chemical companies and big agriculture dominating our food supply and the corruption of our food supply and the GMOs, if it was only that, if it was only any one of them, if it was only three of them, if it was only five of them, but now it's more and more every day. And it doesn't seem to change fundamentally, no matter which political party is in power. That's because the big ruse is they're so different. Yeah, they're different, but let me tell you something on a deep, deep level that all of us should be concerned about. They are so similar. And that is because of the money that is necessary. And that is why I believe, just like it took a constitutional amendment to abolish slavery, and it took a constitutional amendment to give women the right to vote, I believe, like many people do, it is going to take a constitutional amendment to outlaw the undue influence of money on our politics and give our country back to our people. Because we, and once again, going back to who we are, we, in our conversation, know that you can't just pretend it's okay when things are not okay. And ladies and gentlemen, we have a very toxic brew of shrinking civil liberties, expanding corporate influence, and domestic surveillance, which is putting our democracy into a nosedive. We are making a mockery of the Gettysburg Address. We are becoming a government of a few of the people, and by a few of the people, and for a few of the people. And that is ultimately unsustainable and bad for everybody. So, you know, not everybody, you know, first of all, not everybody believes that, not everybody's heart is saying that, but I feel that there's a critical mass of Americans who are feeling like, just as, you know, I think Paul Hawken, the environmentalist, used that term, blessed unrest. When something's wrong in your life, I always say if you have this nagging suspicion you're wasting your life, it's because you are. You know, psychic pain is like physical pain. It's there for a reason. This is not a time in America to, you know, this. Who's not on pharmaceuticals these days? This is like an epidemic. We talk about a war on drugs. The biggest drug epidemic is in medicine cabinets today. The biggest drug epidemic is deemed okay because the pharmaceuticals are making so much money on it. This is not a time to be numb. We're numb because without being numb, we feel that we would be in pain. Why are we in pain? Because we know something's wrong here. Particularly women. It's so important. You know, I heard a story once, and I saw that you have I'll come to you, ma'am. This is a fascinating story. To me, it's fascinating. And it's about a group of chimpanzees in Africa. And the group of chimpanzees, there was some scientists, some anthropologists, who visited this village of chimpanzees, a village in Africa, and they noticed that a certain percentage, I think it was 10%, I'm not sure, of the chimpanzees seemed depressed. They were not sleeping with the other chimpanzees, and they were not dancing with the other chimpanzees. They were not eating, they were not sleeping, they were not playing, they were not doing things with the other chimpanzees. They just seemed by themselves and not happy. And so the anthropologists found that was so fascinating, because they saw that it was the same, basically the same kind of thing that happens in human systems. So they wanted to know the effect on the chimpanzee village if they took the depressed chimps away. Are you with me? Now, if you know the answer to this, please don't say it. They took the depressed, so-called depressed chimps away from the village, and they came back 6 months later. What do you think they found when they returned 6 months later? What? Some others had become depressed. Any other? Is that your final answer? You know what they found? The entire village of chimps was dead. What they realized was that the depressed chimps were the early warning system of the village. They were depressed because they could see that the storm clouds were coming, or they could feel that the earthquake was coming, or they could see that the snakes were coming or the elephants were coming or whatever, and that's why they were depressed. And when the other chimps saw that they were depressed, they knew to do something. So what we've got is a bunch of people who are feeling like something's off, something's off, something's off. And then we go to just mask it as though, like, if I had a broken leg, I would simply mask the pain but not reset the leg. And so we all know from the spiritual and the metaphysical and the personal growth and recovery conversation, sometimes you need to burn through that pain. Because that's where wisdom lies. You know, I read a book recently that came out, Sue Monk Kidd's latest book. You know, she wrote Secret Life of Bees. She wrote that marvelous book, The Mermaid Chair. Her newest book is called The Invention of Wings. Has anybody read it? It's great, isn't it? I had never thought before about white Southern abolitionists. And there were a lot of Southern abolitionists. This book is based on a true story, two women called the Grimke sisters, who were born to a well-to-do slave-owning family in Charleston, South Carolina, and ultimately became world-famous abolitionists, and one of them wrote the first feminist manifesto. And what that book was about was the psychological and emotional and spiritual unfoldment within these girls, as it would be for anyone in a slave-owning family, as a child, to awaken to what's going on here. That little black girl is not just my friend. She's my slave. Mommy gave her to me. And then ultimately to know that means there is evil here in this house. There is evil here in this town. This, my community, my people,
this is evil. And for me, to separate myself from the evil will mean separating myself from those people I love who will then cast me out. So I learned from reading this book such insight about the layers and layers of psychological and emotional processes that people had to go through before giving birth, because we're pregnant and then we give birth. It happens inside, it gestates, and then we give birth to what you and I can see externally as having been the abolitionist movement. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the best of all. In American history, not only have the great spiritual movements never been separate from the great political journeys of our country, they have always been the foundation of the great political movements of our country. Abolition emerged from the Quakers. And women's suffrage emerged from the Quakers. And civil rights movement emerged from Martin Luther King, the preacher from Georgia, and the Southern Christian Leadership Council. And that is because only people who are standing and dwelling within the vertical have real serious power within the horizontal planes of existence. Yes, ma'am. There's a lady there who's had your hand up.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. My main thing is I've been reading a lot of Abraham Hicks in The Vortex, and a lot of things that she says is to kind of ignore things that aren't making you joyful and happy and things like that. And I'm a social worker, so I'm in the field in the trenches, and it's hard for me not to be mad all the time, and it's hard for me not to be burnt out and pissed off all the time. And I've been kind of trying to, like, teeter on the fence, like the same thing, like with not doing political work, not doing anything, and just focus on just being happy, you know. And it's just kind of like from what you're saying, how do you stay in the vortex or in line and still recognize all the pain and still take action with all the pain around you?
You wake up in the morning and you meditate and you do your inner work and you call to mind all of the people you are going to be working with today as a social worker, all the people you're going to be serving, all the people who you know you're going to be serving, and all the people you don't even know yet who you will be serving. And you blast them with love, pray for them, whatever your process is, in advance. You do this in the morning. And you know that on the earthly plane, you're a social worker. But on a spiritual plane, you're what we all are. You were there to minister unto the children of God with your love. Now, as you do that, you will experience yourself, as I said before, as the faucet, not the water. And if you experience yourself as the faucet, not the water, you don't take it personally. You know that, of course, I'm sent out into the darkness. That's my mission on the planet, as it is everyone's. But I come with love, and there is no limit to what love can do. So you are dwelling in the experience for more than just the level of the experience. Einstein saying we cannot solve the problem on the level of the problem. So that's number one, that you realize this is not with your physical eye. It's those people, you, physical, mortal mind, that job. But in a larger sense, you are there literally. And truly, what a blessed ministry it is to be a social worker, because you are ministering unto the suffering masses. You really are. Now, anger limits our effectiveness, just as complacency is an excuse for not helping. Whining is immature, but what you are learning would conceivably only strengthen your conviction and your commitment that the level of unnecessary suffering that is occurring in our country because of the basic injustices created by a siphoning off over the last few decades of vast material resources into the hands of a very few through banking policies, through tax policies, through trade policies, you're seeing firsthand
in your work, in your career, the unnecessary suffering that this produces, right? And so because you are informed at the deepest level. So you are someone who can answer the call of this moment like nobody's business. You've been there. You've seen it. It's firsthand. And you know that no amount of private charity can compensate for that basic lack of social justice. You've seen it. You know it. You've been up close. And so you become someone who then can move into this great vortex of spiritual political possibility like nobody's business and say, okay, let's go, let's do this. My hope would be, whether I win or not, someday, given what you've been through, you'll be next. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Hi.
I actually just had a quote I wanted to read you because I find it quite inspiring. And I wanted you to react to it, I suppose, hopefully, as an impending politician.
I'm sorry, sir. I have to tell you, I couldn't hear what you just said. So would you please repeat it, because I have to come down. Would you say that
again?
Yeah,
no worries. There's a quote here I wanted to read you, and hopefully you could respond to, hopefully, as an impending politician, because I really love your policy positions on so many of the issues. The quote is by someone called Penn Jillette. He says, "It's amazing how many people think that voting to have government give poor people money is compassion. Helping poor and suffering people, that is real compassion. But voting for government to use guns to give money to help poor people is immoral, self-righteous bullying, and it's laziness. People need to be fed, they need to be medicated, educated, clothed, sheltered. And if we are a compassionate society, that is what we'll do. But there should be no great joy in helping people through gunpoint and asking government to do that." So I guess my question is, from a spiritual level, often we're taught that we want to change the world through voluntary actions, through compassion, not necessarily through force. So as a great spiritual teacher yourself, how do you reconcile the fact that often government is intrusion, like you say, or it is drone policy or, you know, misguided healthcare policy or these policies, but they try and achieve social engineering through force, whereas the spiritual community in general tries to achieve a greater world through education
what is
and compassion.
What is the force you think that I'm advocating?
No, I don't think you're advocating force at all. I think government itself seeks to create change through force.
I believe that it is the function of government to be the balancing agent between individual liberty, where people get to just do whatever they want to do, because democracy, American democracy, when it was founded, is the greatest context we know so far for self-actualization. Americans and all people living in free societies have a taste for liberty because we have a taste for self-actualization. We want to be whatever we want to be. Get off my case. Get away from me with your chains that would bind me. But government's job is to balance that with a concern for the common good. So that, yeah, you can do whatever you want to do, but if you're pouring carcinogens into the water in that lake and children are going to drink them, stop right there. Yes, you can do whatever you're going to do, but if those actions would actually create an injustice where it's no longer a level playing field and you have more opportunity than everybody else does, stop right there. So just as blood has to circulate in the body in order for the body to be healthy, opportunity has to circulate in the society for the society to be healthy. Everybody, you know, we all celebrate the high side of capitalism. We all celebrate the fact, if I write a book, I create value. And if you feel the book gives you value, you will give me a dollar and you walk away with a book. That's aligned with nature. It's win-win. It's righteous exchange of value. But when you have created a predatory form of capitalism, where it's not about righteous fair exchange, it's about how can I so screw you, manipulate you, and exploit you that I get the most from you while giving you the least. There's nothing aligned with nature there. And when government is doing more to support that than to support the former, we are in trouble. Because let me tell you something. That you just read, and I don't know about the person who wrote it, but the general coding there, it's code. It's code for why give money to entitled poor people. Well, let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. Entitlement, any sense of entitlement, anytime anybody thinks they don't have to work for themselves, let the government do it for me, I'm entitled to that. That's ugly no matter who is holding that thought. But the suck on the U.S. economy of poor people thinking that way is a fraction of the suck on the U.S. economy by rich people thinking that way. So, you know, I'm all for not giving people more than they deserve. That's why we shouldn't be giving multi-billion dollar subsidies to an oil industry that makes a $1 trillion profit. You know, Martin Luther King said, if they give it to the poor, they call it a handout. If they give it to the rich, they call it a subsidy. Yes. And I just love saying this in Bel Air and Beverly Hills. I just love it. I just love it. And because we're all American. And we all know that we all want to feel like we can win, but that so can everybody else if they work hard. You know, I don't believe any socioeconomic group has a monopoly on righteousness. And we have to really remember that, because this is not about demonizing individuals. This is about holding systems accountable. And that's a real important part of the conversation.
Hi, Marianne. I'm Marianne too. I'm from Australia. Firstly, I'd just like to say thank you.
Thank you.
Really, thank you. And my question to you is, would you mind just sharing what your spiritual practice is on a daily basis?
Well, I'm a student of A Course in Miracles, so I read the Course on a daily basis. And the Course includes, it is three books. There's a text that's the intellectual basis of the Course, and there's also a workbook, which is the crux of the Course, because it is how we take the journey without distance from the head to the heart. I'm also a student of transcendental meditation. So I have a TM mantra as well as the Course in Miracles. But I also realize that as important as it is to do my practice in the morning and throughout the day that I just said to you, I also realize that the most important practice is to practice what I preach to the best of my ability. So my biggest practice is recognizing when I just said something or I just did something that was not the angel of my better nature. When I'm not being forgiving, when I'm holding on, when I'm being, my daughter says, you're not controlling, Mommy, you're just domineering, whatever. Whatever. That, I think, for a lot of us is really the practice, which is not just the meditation. You know, for me, and I think for a lot of us, I might meditate in the morning, and that certainly means that my chances of really falling off the spiritual wagon are greatly diminished throughout the day. But it also increases the probability that when I do fall off the spiritual wagon, I'll catch myself before having done something seriously stupid, before having picked up the phone, before having opened my mouth, before having pushed the send button. And that's where most of us are. And I want to conclude just by saying this. First of all, I want to acknowledge, because some of you might not know, I know many of you are here to see Barbara Marx Hubbard, but I just want to make clear for anyone who might not know that Barbara Marx Hubbard once was in nomination at the Democratic Convention for vice president, is the idol and the hero of us all when it comes to spirituality and politics put together. So Barbara Marx Hubbard, please just stand up so you can get more.
Well, it's great to live long enough to see it happen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you. I love you. I thank you very, very much for the experience that all of us are having here together. And let us just take this moment to dedicate ourselves once again to enter the internal place, the sacred space within our hearts. And each of us asks for guidance of the eternal wisdom by whatever name we call that higher truth. Use me.
May I be guided where I might best be of use. May my gifts unfold in service to the whole. May I meet my mighty collaborators. May love so fill my heart that fear is cast out. May my personality so transform that my rough edges are dissolved. And may the path be placed before us. May we feel angels to our left and angels to our right, as there are angels in front of you and angels behind you, as there are angels above you and angels below. We send our love to everyone else in this room. We send our love to everyone else in this world. We thus go forth in confidence, and we go forth in peace. For there is alive within us an eternal presence of love, all-powerful and everlasting. And so it is. Amen. God bless you, everybody. Thank you so much. You've been lovely being with you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Marianne Williamson. I say Marianne for president. Absolutely. We'll be doing a book signing, a very fast book signing, over here to your right. Thank you so much. And remember that website, $5, MarianneForCongress.com.